Good news for Ukraine. The former Soviet Republic won its first Winter Olympic medal since 2006 on Monday when Vita Simarenko took the bronze in the women's 7.5-kilometer biathlon sprint. But Olympic enthusiasm may be dulled for the thousands of Ukrainians who have been demonstrating in Maidan Square in Kiev since November, protesting their pro-Russian president, Viktor Yanukovych. I'm Jim Meadows, and today on Focus, we're talking about the political unrest in Ukraine with University of Illinois political science professor Carol Leff and U of I law student and Ukraine native Irina Sinatska. Focus continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Some fast facts about Ukraine. It's the largest nation in terms of landmass that is located wholly in Europe. Only the European portion of Russia is larger. It has four times the land area of Illinois, nearly four times the population. Ukraine is a breadbasket, a major exporter of grain and other crops. And Ukraine is name-checked in the classic Beatles song Back in the USSR. Of course, Ukraine hasn't been part of the USSR for more than 20 years. As part of the collapse of the old Soviet Union, Ukraine declared its independence in 1991, ratified by a referendum. But Russia's current leaders want to keep Ukraine in their sphere of influence, even as many Ukrainians hope to reach out to Western Europe. And that's led to the current moment in Maidan Square in the Ukrainian capital of Kiev, where tens of thousands of Ukrainians have been demonstrating since November against their president, Viktor Yanukovych, for resisting closer ties to the European Union. But I've left out a lot of detail that I hope we can fill in during this hour of Focus. And to provide those details about Ukraine, I want to welcome two members of the University of Illinois community to the program today. Carol Leff is an associate professor of political science at the U of I, and Irina Sunatska is a native of Ukraine and currently a U of I law student. And Carol and Irina, welcome to Focus.
Good morning.
Thank you.
And before we get into the questions and answers, I want to invite you to ask your questions about Ukraine as well. You can call us at 1-800-222-9455. You can send an email to will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again, 1-800-222-WILL. Besides phone or email, you can reach us on Twitter or Facebook at Focus580. Carol, I was wondering, because we're looking now at what I gather is a sort of tug of war between the European Union and Russia, with Ukraine in the middle. And where did this tug of war originate?
Well, it's actually very old because of the positioning that you mentioned of Ukraine in between Russia and the rest of Europe. And it also is internalized in that there are linguistic and regional differences within Ukraine, with the West and Central having more ethnic Ukrainian and Ukrainian speakers, and the East and South having even a significant population of ethnic Russians and others, Russophones, who speak Russian. And there tends to be a somewhat different orientation between the two regions that reflects itself in not just now, but in politics in Ukraine from the very beginning. If you want to look at the maps on electoral geography, which is a website, you can see that in each election, there are red states and blue states, that the Western and Central tend to vote more for candidates that are oriented toward the West, and the East and South tend to vote more for candidates that are oriented toward Russia.
Irina, maybe you can talk about this. You're from the western section of Ukraine, you and your family?
Yes, Jim.
And does it work like that as far as how you feel and most people you know in that part of the country, how you feel about things politically?
Absolutely. The western Ukraine is definitely focused towards the West, towards Europe, and the East has always been traditionally, and unfortunately, even now, even though it's getting a little bit more divided, it's still looking to the East.
Now, how did this play out in the Orange Revolution of 2004?
Well, that was almost a classic case. And, of course, it's important because the protests of the presidential election of 2004 are kind of a precursor. You can see very similar mobilizations. In that year, the incumbent president Kuchma was retiring after his two terms, and he anointed Yanukovych, the current president, as his successor. Yanukovych was strong in the East and South, and in fact, he campaigned in Russian a lot of the time. And Yushchenko, the eventual victor after the protests, had his base and his policy orientation toward the West. His wife was a Ukrainian American, and he, embraced the idea of joining the EU and so forth. And the electoral map shows that each had their stronghold. Well, that election was stolen, and that triggered the protests. So there was a very focused event, just as there is this time, only it was about electoral fairness, which in some respects is a broader issue. So the Orange Revolution that occurred after the first results came back and electoral forensics could show you some suspicious elements in those elections, turnouts that were over 100% and late returns from the Russian regions. We in the larger Illinois area have seen this in Chicagoland politics before. But at the point at which it appeared that Yanukovych was going to be declared the winner, the protests broke out. So you have the same kinds of divisions as you do now, only over a specifically electoral fraud issue.
Now, so it's interesting, because of the Orange Revolution, and I want to ask, why orange? What's the significance of orange?
European politics was historically color-coded. So parties tend to have, and this goes back to the 19th century, where greens were peasants or farmer parties and blacks were conservative parties for the black color of the clergy. But still to today, without as much, sort of symbolic significance, parties tend to adopt a color that is, so they can be recognized in demonstrations and so forth. And the Yushchenko campaign and his party adopted the color orange. So when the fraudulent elections were challenged, the color of the revolution became orange for the candidate that the protesters felt had been defrauded of his victory.
Well, Yushchenko then did take office.
That's right.
But a few years later, in 2010, Yanukovych was elected president.
That's right. And Yanukovych had also been prime minister in the intervening time for a while, which is why I say you can't oversimplify this, because there were supporters of Yanukovych. But part of it, part of his victory was that the disillusionment after the Orange Revolution, that things were not cleaned up the way they should have been.
Is that how things look to you, Irina? Did the reformers not do as effective job as they promised?
Absolutely. They tried. A lot of people's opinion in Ukraine is that they tried playing democratics too soon. They did not weed out the corruption in time, and they kept it in the office and eventually just took back over.
Mm-hmm. So we bring up to this moment, and I understand it was in November when President Yanukovych made it clear that he was not going to sign an association agreement with the European Union, which is what work had been leading up to do, but instead see closer economic ties with Russia. And, if I say something like that in America, maybe NAFTA would be that controversial. But most people don't think about trade agreements with that sort of fire and spark. But here there really was a lot of fire and spark involved when Yanukovych made that decision. And that's when demonstrations started, I take it.
Yes. Right now it's very difficult for Ukrainians to even enter the EU. It costs 35 euros just to get a visa, if allowed to get a visa. An average Ukrainian makes about 300 euros a month. A lot of students were hoping for this as an opportunity to be able to travel abroad, to be able to study, and really just grow. So it was very devastating for them, because they were the ones who were really betting their future on this.
And there's a lot of people in Ukraine, you were talking about young people, look to Europe, to Western Europe, as a place as a place that can be part of their future.
Absolutely. They look to the way things run, the standards. They want the same regulations. They want the same fairness. They want an ability to enter university without having to pay a bribe. They want those kind of standards.
So closer ties with Russia instead, what would that signify for them?
For them, it would just signify going back to how things were, going back to the Soviet era, and essentially corruption and just being stuck in one place the way they have been for all these years since.
Demonstrations are taking out in Maiden Square, and I was telling Carol, I think you were telling me that the word maiden means square. So if I say Maiden Square, I'm saying square, square.
Mm-hmm. Well, Maidan, actually, we were just discussing this with a friend. It actually means almost like a playground. Maidan is a field. Like you can have a soccer field. It's a Maidan.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
So it is essentially means a square, but for us, it's independence. Maidan is a largeness is independence square.
Mm-hmm. So it has that sort of significance as a sort of a national site that belongs to the country.
Precisely.
Something like, say, the National Mall in Washington, D.C. for my country.
Absolutely, yes.
Now, I understand you're here with your family in the United States. You've been here since when?
1999.
Since 1999. But you still have extended family back in Ukraine. And I understand some of them are taking part in the protests.
Yes, both friends and family are taking part in the protests, both in 2004 and now. They're doing it either going to Kiev or also Lviv, which is the city I'm from in western Ukraine. As you know, the protests are happening all over the country. So they're all participating, and it's a bit tough.
What sort of size? I understand tens of thousands in Kiev. In a smaller city like Lviv, what size do the protests get to?
They get into tens of thousands. I mean, people from all around the region come in. They're blockading. They're effectively blockading military sites so that the military wouldn't be able to access the actual city. And the situation is different because in the West, the military does support the people. The government supports the people. Our mayor actually said that they would not allow Berkut, which is the protest police, to enter the city. And the military is actually working with the people.
This is Focus, and we're talking about the current crisis in Ukraine with Irina Sunatska. She is a native of Ukraine and a law student at the University of Illinois. And Carol Leff, political science professor at the U of I. If you have questions about Ukraine, call us. The phone number is 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WYLL. Our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. Have you talked to people back home about what it's like being part of these protests, what the experience is like?
Absolutely. I was just on the phone with a friend of mine who lives in Kiev this morning, and the situation, it's not really improving that much. He's currently working with a friend of his who has been arrested. He's a student. He was walking down the street and past a dormitory. And there's a lot of profiling against the young people, so it's dangerous to even be on the streets, really. He was arrested for 2 weeks. There was no evidence supporting that he was part of the revolution or the protest, but that's what he was charged with. And he's currently in prison, still fighting the charges.
And he was in Kiev.
Yes, but he lives in Kiev.
Okay. And I understand that there had been laws sent out by the president against, or by the government anyway, against protests, which had then been rescinded. A prime minister resigned, I think, as an effort to calm things down. Carol, do you see these things having any effect?
Well, they haven't so far. It's clear. I mean, you know, one of the things that was true in the Orange Revolution, and it's going to be part of this story, too, in some way, is that one of the reasons that the situation was resolved is that the Constitutional Court of Ukraine upheld a legal action to rerun the election. This time, the president is groping for an exit strategy that would also be constitutional, even as what's happening on the streets isn't particularly legal, and is, you know, and is, you know, stirs up yet more anger. But yeah, what he did first, which was extremely stupid in January, was to ram through a bunch of a package of anti-protest laws, things that we would consider, you know, that would, you know, that made a vaguely defined extremism liable to penalty, things that would curb the action of independent civil society groups and so forth. And then all hell broke loose again, and he had to back down, and Parliament reversed itself. So, but at the same time, he offered the prime ministership to some of the opposition leaders, who turned it down because what they're asking for now is new elections, so that the public gets a chance to choose the leaders, and that Yanukovych himself, as president, doesn't just pass the baton to someone.
So it sounds like originally this was about the European Union Association Agreement, and now it's become something larger. It's about the government and who's in power.
Yes. And, you know, and, you know, to go back, though, there's just one thing that I think we should discuss at least later on, is the interesting thing is Yanukovych actually initialed the association agreement with the EU and was going ahead, and it looked like he was going to sign it. I mean, it wasn't, you know, the customs union with Russia as an alternative really wasn't on the table until Russia started leaning on Ukraine. And what makes that possible is the economic crisis there. Okay, so something we might think about later.
Issues of control and with Russia, and also control, who's in charge of what parts of Ukraine, I want to get to in a moment. But let's go ahead and take a phone call. We have on line one, Paul from Champaign County. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Yeah, it's very hard to be as nuanced as I'd like to be in a short phone call like this, but I support both sides of this, it's very good that the fact that there are two sides in Ukraine was emphasized from the very beginning. I support an opening and a political opening, but the problem is that doesn't get talked about much is the EU's austerity program, which many Ukrainians, fellow religionists, the Orthodox religion in Greece, are suffering from, was part of what was included. So the U.S. is all very much in favor of political freedom, but the other parts of the UN Charter, for instance, economic justice is not high on their agenda. And when you have the example of this Noland woman, Assistant Secretary of State, I guess I'm not sure what exactly her position is. I do have it in front of me, but this leaked phone call where she is moving the players in the Ukrainian opposition around like on a chessboard and saying that guy's out, this guy's in, and then blanking the EU, you know, it's the U.S. has hoisted on its own petard of revelations of spying on phone calls. But so I just think that Stephen Cohen also has a dissident view on this, and one of the things that isn't talked about much in the Ukrainian opposition, and I don't want to paint them all in a broad stroke, but it does include some very, very reactionary anti-Semitic forces that doesn't get commented on. I just think there's a misapprehension, and it's a distortion of the Cold War. The earlier crisis that happened vis-a-vis the U.S. and Russia, that I think it kind of illuminates the ignorance of the circumstances, the previous crisis with Georgia, where territories that were given to Georgia by Stalin were seen as integral to, you know, Georgia, and people like McCain were up there posturing, which they also did in Ukraine, about how, you know, the integrity of Georgia has to be respected, and, you know, not looking at the historical background of the circumstance. So I hope I got some of those nuances out. I'm not for a draconian crackdown on occupying a square, just as I wasn't for the draconian response that the U.S. did to the Occupy movement, for instance. So a lot there, and I just think that people ought to look into this with a lot more subtlety than well, Putin's behind it all, and I have no brief for Putin, that's for sure. But I just think that the economic dimension is not treated. The fact that the EU offered, you know, $600 million in some kind of package, and that the pipeline for gas that goes through the Ukraine, which I guess Ukraine means border. Anyway, I better not keep going, because I probably could. But thanks very much, and I hope you can treat some of those subtleties of the issue. Thank you.
Okay, Paul. Thank you very much. And well, let's see how we can crack this open. One of the things I heard Paul talking about was looking at the austerity programs that the European Union has been, you know, has been working with some of the nations in really financial trouble from the recent recession. I don't know if an association agreement brings you closely into that those sort of issues.
Yeah. Yes, in a way it does, in a fairly direct way. You know, I tried to parse the economics of this myself about what the pros and cons of the two economic agreements are, and it's rather difficult to decide how to evaluate it. But one thing I can say is that the logic of opening Ukraine to the Western market and to Western travel does come with it a number of stipulations that the EU has. You have to integrate with our economic legal structure. Okay, so I think I remember the figure 380 laws that they would expect the Ukrainian parliament to pass, okay, all of which would align them more closely with the EU, what its short-run effects might be. That would be disruptive, although the comparison figures are, suggest that that's a better deal than the Russian custom union would offer, which does not mean that there wouldn't be some stress there, and it doesn't mean that everyone would benefit equally, because one of the effects of neoliberal policies, and the EU is not neoliberal in the sense it's highly regulatory too, is that inequality can increase even as the economy is growing. So it's not straightforward, but what Irina said about this opening, some of my Ukrainian friends in academia, before the Schengen, before Poland joined the EU, could move back and forth freely across that border, visit colleagues in Warsaw or Krakow, and now they can't. And this would reverse that unfortunate fact that blocks that border.
You mean between Poland and...
Between Poland, which is the EU.
Poland and the Ukraine.
That's right, which is the EU border with Ukraine.
That used to be a much more open border at the time, well, certainly when Ukraine was a Soviet republic,
yeah, but even
and
after,
Poland was a satellite state.
That's right. But even after that, before Poland became part of the Schengen free travel zone, which isn't uniquely EU, but... Yeah,
I take it being part of that travel zone can be pretty attractive.
Oh yes, for doing business, for tourism, for education, for jobs. I mean, yes, that border is significant, and breaking it, would be very useful. As Irina already said.
Well, Irina, the things that Paul brought up and that Carol was just discussing. Some of the laws that would be asked for under the association agreement, are those things that are debated in Ukraine as this controversy goes forth?
Initially, yes, there was some division. There was some division in the West and the East. It was not a uniform. All the West was for EU association, and all the East was for Russian association. It was there was a lot of debate. However, now everything turned on November 30th when the students that were protesting not signing the EU association, they were not huge numbers. Yet when they were really cleared out from the square, that's when really that was the pivotal point of everything turning. And if you speak with a lot of people who are protesting, who are at the square right now, they will tell you this is not about the EU anymore. Mm-hmm. This is about our rights. This is about the corruption. This is about what's happened since we came out here, since our children came out here.
Yeah. And one of the things that you can see in public opinion polling is in the lead up to the moment, this agreement, the association agreement, had already been initialed in, I think, the spring or maybe even in 2012. But the public was fairly split, 46, this is roughly right, 33. Mm-hmm. So yeah. Plurality favored the agreement, but by no means even a majority. If you look at the figures in December, support for the customs union with Russia had gone down quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't so much about the pros and cons of the agreement, but just about the protests, the reactions, the feeling that Ukraine was being pushed around, which mm-hmm. unfortunately, historically, being in between major economic and political forces has been Ukraine's fate.
So perhaps, at least in the short term, mm-hmm. The crackdown was not a good political move for President Yanukovych.
Absolutely not. I mean, that's what sparked where he is now.
Well, let's take a short break now. We have a caller we'll get back to when we return, when we talk more about the situation in Ukraine with U of I law student and Ukraine native Irina Sinatska and Carol Leff, political science professor here at the University of Illinois. This is Focus on WILL. Welcome back to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're discussing the situation in Ukraine, where demonstrators opposed to Russia's continuing influence in the country are protesting in the capital city, Kiev, against Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych. My guests are Irina Sinatska, a native of Ukraine and a law student at the University of Illinois, and U of I political science professor Carol Leff. I wanted to make note of an event that's coming up this Friday afternoon, and that is a panel discussing what's going on in the Ukraine, run by the Russian East European and Eurasian Center at the U of I. It's called Understanding the Ukrainian Maidan. Am I pronouncing that right?
Maidan.
Mm-hmm. We all want to say Maiden here, but it's Maidan. Understanding the Ukrainian Maidan between Russia and the EU. Carol Leff, you'll be a panelist there, mm-hmm. as will Kostas Kordakakis, a lecturer in political science, and Oleksandra Wallo, a lecturer in Slavic languages and literature. So that'll be taking place at the Library and Information Science Building at 501 East Daniel Street in Champaign, room 126. That's this Friday from 1 to 3 p.m. We have a caller that's been waiting patiently, David from Urbana on line 2. And good morning. You're on Focus.
Yes. Pursuant to the comments that were made just before the break, I think people aren't aware generally of the close relationship of the Ukraine and Poland through the Middle Ages and down into the, I think, 18th century. They were at times unified. At times, the Ukraine would be the capital, and at mm-hmm. other times, the capital would be in Poland. And it's a very, very important relationship that only ended when the neighboring powers divided up Central Europe.
Yeah. Yes, you could go further than that, because after World War II, one of the things Stalin did, which politically turned out to be very stupid by 1991, is move the Soviet borders west into Poland and then move Poland west into Germany, gobbling up the Baltic states, which had been independent between the two wars, and taking parts of pulling into Ukraine a mixed border area which had never been part of the Russian Empire, but had been part of Poland when Poland was divided. It had been part of interwar Poland. So, yeah, that boundary. And how many names are there for your city, Irina, in different languages?
At least five.
Yes, right. That reflects that history of the way the Poland and Ukrainian borderlands are intertwined. So that's a very good point. And it's, you know, it's a reference point, not just sort of EU-Russia, but, you know, that whole region between Russia and what we call the West.
As a matter of fact, I was talking with, I was talking with a former intern of ours, Sherelle Starr, who has visited Ukraine on a Fulbright scholarship and has been following the situation. And I was asking him about, I guess there is a movement for Ukraine, in fact, your city,
Lviv,
to host a Winter Olympics in 2022. And Terrell was wondering if perhaps it might be a project that was done perhaps in cooperation with Poland. He seemed to think that that was something that was not outside the realm of possibility.
Well, that wouldn't be the first time. We just hosted, along with Poland, the Euro Cup, which is a European soccer tournament. And especially that region, it's always been collaborating with Poland. My city, we still don't know. There's still argument where it originated, whether it was Polish or Ukrainian, until today.
So when we see a situation where Ukraine is looking for closer ties with the EU and closer ties with Poland, which is part of the EU, but Poland being a former Soviet satellite and Ukraine being a former Soviet republic, what does that look like to the leaders of the Russian Federation?
Well, probably a bit intimidating, considering that would mean movement away or less control over the region.
Yeah. If you think all the way back to 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, the timetable, there was a coup in August. But the triggering event that pulled apart the Soviet Union in early December was the Ukrainian vote for independence. Referendum. Mm-hmm. And when that referendum passed handily, the Russian President Yeltsin decided, without Ukraine, what's the point of the Soviet Union? He got together with the Ukrainian president and the Belarusian president, and basically just said, there's no constitutional path for this. Soviet Union is over. Okay, and what comes next? We hope there's some kind of relationship. So that is, for Russians, that is a very important area. It's, you know, Kiev and Rus, which is geographically Ukraine, is regarded by many Russians as the founding state.
When we say Kiev and Rus, we're talking about a land, a people, a government that existed centuries ago.
Yeah, 1,000 years ago.
Yes.
Right. But that was the area where Orthodox Christianity was embraced by the
Eastern region.
The Eastern regions, you know, the Russian and, you know, that whole region. But Moscow was a later later state. To say either of them was actually ethnically Ukrainian or Russian at that point is probably wrong. But for Russians, there's a lot of resonance for Ukraine.
Well, this is interesting, and I want to thank David for calling in and bringing this up. As we were talking about ties between Poland and also ties between Russia and Ukraine, we're looking at a country where many people speak Ukraine and many Ukrainian and many people speak Russian. And I assume many people speak both.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, there are, at least according to Wikipedia, about 18 recognized regional languages. I was wondering, what are the languages you speak back home?
Well, Ukrainian is the predominant one. But growing up in Ukraine, I also learned Russian and Polish as well. Because of my geographic position, Polish was something I heard often.
So you came to college being trilingual.
Yes.
And but that's also a marker in some ways of who you are in Ukraine, and somebody in the eastern part of Ukraine would be speaking a different set of languages, perhaps.
Absolutely. You know, there have been incidents where I ran into somebody Ukrainian who could not speak Ukrainian with me. And I've known people from the West who do not speak Russian at all. So sometimes it's interesting what happens in Kiev, at the capital, where the two meet.
And it just sounds there's got to be a lot of difficulty in settling out the country's future direction when you have these two cultural streams coming in. They haven't quite blended. It's not a melting pot quite, is it? And some people might wanted to see it at a melting pot, but that's not what it is yet.
Yeah. You know, one of the issues is linguistic. Should Russian be a second official language or not? That's a subject of controversy in the country.
And there have been controversial laws also, ones that are allowing Russian being taught in school or being schools that are only taught in Russian in certain regions versus having only Ukrainian language as instructions language. So there have been a lot of laws that are controversial. However, I think as the situation progresses, people are starting to realize that language is something that can be tabled prior to larger issues of corruption.
I've been wondering, when Paul called, he brought up, I think, the ideas of the U.S., of the U.S.'s role in this whole affair and the leaked tapes, which were somewhat embarrassing, with the U.S. diplomatic official speaking disparagingly in not so many words of the European Union. What's in it for the U.S.? What happens to Ukraine? What does it mean to Americans? What happens in Ukraine?
I think that, we were talking about how much coverage this did and didn't get. The trigger issue was what was in it for the EU and what is in it for, for Western Europe, which is always of concern to us. We don't want that area destabilized. But I think that it would have been interesting if the issue had been otherwise. Going back to Poland, incidentally, one of the reasons that during the Orange Revolution that the EU got involved and the West got involved was that Poland, as a member of the EU, was so adamant. They just entered the EU and was so adamant that their neighbor Ukraine, ought to get the attention of the West.
So this is important to Poland.
Of course it is. I mean, we've talked about the relationship. What I'm saying is, it would have been interesting. I think that we are concerned about the stability of any of that region, but the EU and in Europe is more concerned because those boundaries between the EU and its neighboring states, which they've encapsulated in what they call a neighborhood policy, the EU neighborhood policy, has big economic stakes as well as stability stakes.
And as far as the United States or any country that's a proponent of democracy, this should be relevant, because this is the situation right now. There is no real democracy. And if we are the proponents of democracy, as we say, then this is absolutely relevant and important as well.
I want to mention that we still have time for your calls here on Focus to talk about the situation in Ukraine with Irina Sunatska. She's a law student here at the U of I and a native of Ukraine, and with U of I political science professor Carol Leff. Our phone numbers are 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. I take it then that for Russia, for the Russian Federation, for Vladimir Putin, the stakes are higher. It's if they lose economic influence over Ukraine, it's more than just a matter of losing face. It's something that really counts for Russia.
Russia has control over the neighboring regions through the means of trade. A lot of the former states rely on it for trade, and they're the only exporters and importers for those states. Losing Ukraine would be losing one of those states to control, to be able to trade on cheaper grounds. There's a lot of business in Ukraine, especially eastern, that Russian businessmen are involved in, coal mining, those kind of things. So it would be losing more than just status, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, at least going into this crisis, Ukraine traded almost equally with the EU and Russia. But we probably ought to mention, the big card that Russia holds, which is the energy card, because Ukraine does not have the oil and natural gas supplies but they do rely on Russian energy supplies. And in the past, on several occasions, Russia has turned off the tap.
Okay. That's actually Gazprom. It's actually a private company, but the Russian government certainly has a lot of sway with Gazprom.
Yeah, right. And there are also oil pipelines. And in fact, what Russia has done in cooperation with Western Europe is build an undersea pipeline to send natural gas and to bypass Ukraine, which, you know, which is up and running now, I think has been for the last 2 years maybe.
And there's also an aid package that Ukraine got from Russia. When I'm reading, I'm looking at a recent Time magazine report, which summarizes it just really sketchily, but that when President Yanukovych decided not to go with the European Union but went for closer ties with Russia, what he got was a $15 billion loan from Russia, enough to help Ukraine avoid bankruptcy because the government's finances are not the best right now. But as the demonstrations have continued, Moscow froze the emergency loan on January 30th, and this apparently has led to some of the crackdown that's happened since then.
Yeah. And that aid package, the $15 billion and some energy subsidies, was up front a lot more than the EU could directly offer by an order of magnitude. Whatever the long-term economic effects were, Ukraine has been in economic sort of fiscal crisis since, for the last year, and, on the verge of not being able to pay its debts. Its foreign currency reserves are down. It's in deep trouble, which is why Russia could make a deal, an offer they couldn't refuse.
And that is why I do say that it was disputed about the EU association within the people, because it wasn't clear whether this was a better package or another package would be a better option. However, it is the long-term effect that people are concerned about, the political effect, not just the monetary bailout that's happening right now, but what will it mean later on for Ukraine? Are we tied down? Are we now to be the little brother once again?
Let's go ahead and take another call. Line one, Lawrence in Savoy. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning, all. I just wanted a small educational input here. What U.S. state is the approximate size in land mass to Ukraine?
And I was wondering about that. I was able to figure out it's worth about, three Illinois. but would California be approximate? Or is that not big enough? I'm hearing crickets here. Does anybody know the answer to this? Lawrence, did you know the answer?
That's why I called.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I'm afraid I'd have to look it up. Yeah.
Well, I'll do what I can as quickly as
but
I can.
Yeah, it sounds like it probably has to be a western state.
Mm-hmm. If we have three Illinois.
Yeah.
I know I was comparing it with California. Ukraine has more people than California, that is for sure, because I think California has about 38 million people, and Ukraine is more like, 46, 48?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if I can find the landmass here. Here we are, 233,000 square miles is the landmass for Ukraine. And by the miracle of the internet, let's see what I can find out about California. Sorry for the pauses here. Here we are. About 163,000 square miles, so bigger than California. I don't know if they're as big as Alaska, but it's certainly a sizable country, and as I said at the beginning of the program, the largest country in Europe that is entirely in Europe in terms of landmass. Yeah. So that's really a major part of the European continent.
Yeah, and one of the things about that landmass is that Ukraine, misgovernment has paid a heavy price, because Ukraine at the beginning was considered a new state that might do quite well. It has rich agricultural land. Its energy source is unfortunately coal, which is, not as environmentally useful. But it was a very developed part of the former Soviet Union. And as in Russia, a lot of what they call oligarchs, that is business tycoons with close ties to government, are part of the corruption story that has been mentioned here today, and it's very important. So, you know, it has the breadbasket of the former Soviet Union. It has a lot of resources and human capital, and you know, so it's no wonder that people are so disappointed with the quality of government that they've had.
That is a question. We have a country which is rich in a lot of ways, but its government is really on the brink financially. How did it get that way?
It's the mismanagement, as previously mentioned.
And that is mismanagement of the current government or the past government or all the governments?
From the beginning.
Yeah. One of the major figures of the Orange Revolution on the side of democracy was Yulia Tymoshenko. Now, at the moment, she's in jail for acts that she committed as prime minister, ironically, in making the government, Yanukovych government said, making too good a deal with Russia. But the point I want to make is she was known as the natural gas princess. I mean, she was herself one of these oligarchs that had, you know, fingers in the pie. And in fact, you know, that's the irony of the Orange Revolution. It isn't that when the opposition won, that it was a bunch of new politicians with no ties to the state. Yushchenko, as the new president, had been prime minister before. Tymoshenko, you know, had been an active political figure. I forget what post she had before she became prime minister. So there's a political elite that really is really tied into this economic story about sort of the capitalist Wild West after the collapse of communism.
And that's also one of the things that differentiates the two revolutions. The Orange Revolution was very political. It was politicians as leaders of the revolution. Here, politicians have to, in this today's situation, politicians have to play on equal footing with the citizens, with even students. The people are not just interested in which political party takes over, because actually the opposition is divided between three parties. And it's more about politically modernizing the state for a long term, not just for who gets to be the next party in power for the next term.
Well, the question is how you can make that sort of change happen, especially now where things are at a crisis. I get the impression that the Olympics put sort of things in hold because Russia's not going to do anything dramatic while everybody's looking at them. But maybe in a few weeks, Vladimir Putin might decide to do something concerning Ukraine. What are people in Ukraine talking about that they fear might happen?
A strong political crackdown, a violent crackdown. Day to day, they're not sure what's coming tomorrow and whether the state's going to back off or infuse more power.
What options do the protesters have, do you think?
They don't have many. It's difficult to even consider what would happen if they backed off right now, because it's the fear of 2004 all over again, going back into the same regime, and whether there would be a chance to ever really, in any near future, to bring this up again to the capacity it has reached right now.
I want to We had another call in from David, who had called earlier, and he was wondering if, in terms of the gas issue, which certainly seems to talk about Ukraine's energy security, if normalizing relations with Iran would help with that. Is Ukraine talking with Iran? What sort of relations does the country have right now?
Yeah. Well, one of the things about energy transport is you can't just put it on a plane or on a train and move it, unless you're talking about coal.
Is there a pipeline path between Iran and Ukraine?
Well, there are pipeline paths that run through Russia.
That does seem to have a little difficulty
that
right
does.
There.
And there are, I mean, this pipeline, what the Russians call transit dependence or transit independence, is, you know, part of the post-Cold War struggle. Can we have pipelines and transport? And natural gas, after all, at this point, unless it's liquefied, which is a technology that's growing, can't just be put on a ship. It has to go through pipelines. So you have to know that you can get something that doesn't pass through Russia. And Russia's worked hard to make sure that it maintains the hub of energy transit.
Well, we're really down to the final minute of the broadcast, and I wanted to bring that over to you, Arina. What are you hoping? What are your hopes for your country as to what will happen next? And can you see a path through to the outcome that you're hoping for?
Well, the true hope is stability and a real change, a change that will be inherited for the years to come. The path is difficult to see. It seems that there definitely needs to be an international intervention or some kind of support from the international community, which we hope we will be getting with as this becomes more relevant and more publicized. But in the end of the day, the true hope is a real change within the government, within the corruption that has really curtailed the opportunities, the career opportunities of the generations that are coming up right now.
Is replacing President Yanukovych the only option that protesters will accept?
At this time, yes, that's their stand.
So an earlier call, we have an email that came in that said there had been a suggestion that Yanukovych might replace everybody in his government except himself. That wouldn't do it.
That's what he's offering.
No, he's already had the government resign. I think the constitutional path is to call early elections. Whether he resigns, in which case the prime minister will be acting president, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And that's an interim cabinet anyway. But early elections would be the constitutional path for a president to resign and end his term early. That's in the Constitution. You can do that.
But whether that will happen, especially with Russia breathing down Ukraine's neck, is another question.
Yeah. Although Putin doesn't really like Yanukovych that much either. So it's interesting.
Well, I want to thank our guests for giving us a window into Ukraine and the political struggle underway there. Thanks to you both. U of I political science professor Carol Leff and Ukraine native and law student Irina Sunachka.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to everyone who called or emailed their questions. Our apologies to anyone who didn't make it to the air. Focus produced by Lindsay Moon, Jason Croft, our technical director, Ryan Weber, our intern. Thanks also to Terrell Starr, a former intern from years back, for his background information on Ukraine. This is Focus on WILL.